This is chapter 34. By the way, I've handed out all my handouts, so if you need a handout, let me know, and I'll bring some more in next week. All right, so catching up with Jacob. We'll read one verse, we'll have a word of prayer, and we'll kind of catch up with Jacob. And it's a tough verse. Chapter 34, verses 1 and 2. It's a tough subject, but we're going to give it its worth. Genesis 34, chapter 34, verse 1 says, "And Dinah, the daughter of Leah, which she bare unto Jacob, went out to see the daughters of the land. And when Shechem, the son of Hamor the Hivite, prince of the country, saw her, he took her and lay with her and defiled her." Let's pray. Father, again, thank you for the chance to gather together this morning. We ask your blessing upon the service to come, Father, but now we ask your blessing upon this Sunday school lesson. Father, give me the words that need to be said and open our hearts and minds to what you have for us on a admittedly very difficult subject, Father, but you have something for us here. We ask, Father, show it to us now this morning. Bless us now, we ask in Jesus' name. Amen. Now, catching up with Jacob. Jacob, of course, has been through a lot. As a young man, he deceived his own brother to get a birthright. He deceived his father to receive a blessing. And then once upon moving to the promised land, he did so to escape Esau's wrath because Esau was going to kill him. Now, while there, he had an encounter with God, the Jacob's Ladder story, which is not a story, it's an event. But after the Jacob's Ladder incident where he met God face to face, after that he behaved morally and righteously for the rest of his life. So no more of that deception he had done earlier in life. But however, he himself was deceived by Laban into serving 7 years for a wife he didn't want, and then 7 years for the wife he did want, and then 6 years for the cattle. So, and during those 20 years, he had his wages changed 10 times by Laban. And I guarantee you they weren't going up. And so he himself has received a lot of deception, a lot of bad treatment. And you could say that's karma, and potentially so, paying for his sins. But it led to some difficult times for him. Now, he had returned home, and on his way home, he knew Esau was waiting for him. And he feared Esau's wrath, deservedly so, probably. And yet, once he met Esau, they had a great reunion. They got a brotherly hug, and everything was forgiven. And he was welcomed home. Now that he's back home, he's built a home and shelters for his flocks. And you think things are going well, but something terrible is about to happen. We read in chapter 34, verse 1. And again, Dinah went out to see the daughters of the land. She went out visiting. And Shechem had defiled her. Basically had raped her. I mean, that's the only way you can say it. It was a terrible thing to have happen. Now, the Shechemites were known to be a very violent and vengeful people. Now, this act of defilement was a serious crime and a provocation for any family that it happened to and deserving to seek revenge. Now, it was thought that Dinah would be about 14 or 15 years old, which makes it even worse about this time. Now, Shechem, either through an honest physical attraction or as a means to defend himself against retaliation, seeks to marry Dinah in verse 3, 34:3. "And his soul clave unto Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and he loved the damsel, and spake kindly unto the damsel. And Shechem spake unto his father Hamor, saying, Get me this damsel to wife." Now I'm sorry, too little too late in my book. You've done something horrible and terrible. So is he trying to cover his tracks, or is there an actual physical attraction there? Well, he seems to actually be attracted to her, but it could be a little bit of both. He had done a terrible thing. It may have been terrible in his family's eyes, because they were very violent people. But to any normal family, it's a very difficult and terrible thing to do to someone. But now he wants to marry the woman. And so Jacob finds out what happened to his daughter in verses 5 and on. "And Jacob heard that he had defiled Dinah, his daughter. Now his sons were with his cattle in the field, and Jacob held his peace until they were come." Jacob is experiencing, or at least demonstrating, a lot of patience, and we'll see about why in a few moments. But he could have just taken his wrath then and there, but he's trying to exercise some patience. Verse 6, "And Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out unto Jacob to commune with him." Now, they're going to have a conversation. And again, Jacob is exercising, wow, as a father, that's extreme patience. Because he's seeking a possible solution. Why? Because there are a lot of them, and he doesn't want to have his family attacked by the other family, the Shechemites. And so he's looking, despite the horrible event that's taking place, he's looking for a possible solution. Now, Dinah has 12 brothers, and they find out what's going on, and they want revenge. Verse 7, "And the sons of Jacob came out of the field, and when they heard it, and the men were grieved, and they were very wroth, because he had wrought folly in Israel, in lying with Jacob's daughter, which thing ought not to be done. The folly in Israel means he had defiled the family by this act. And it was an actual description. He had defiled his entire family. Their brothers viewed this as a very serious, violent act and an ultimate disgrace to their family, which of course it was. It was terrible. Now, Hamor, Shechem's father, attempts to make a treaty with Jacob and his family via marriage. This was a common event in those days where if you had a disagreement with another family, you could marry the kids together and make a treaty, and the families would then become intermingled, and it would settle these kinds of things. Now, this is what he was suggesting. So he proposes the marriage, and in verse 9, and make ye marriages with us. I'm sorry, verse 8. And Hamor communed with them, saying, the soul of my son Shechem longeth for your daughter. I pray you give her, him, to wife. Verse 9, and make ye marriages with us, and give your daughters unto us, and take our daughters unto you. Problem is, they only had one daughter, and they already defiled her, so that was kind of empty suggestion. But he's welcoming, or at least offering the chance to do this intermarriage, to settle this. He knew his son had done a terrible thing, and he's trying to make it right. But he also knew Jacob was wealthy. He had a lot of possessions. So he's looking at the economic side of this as well, in addition to trying to save his son. So, verse 10, and ye shall dwell with us, and the land shall be before you, dwell and trade ye therein, and give you possessions therein. So he's trying to make an economic appeal to Jacob, who's already quite wealthy, but this is all he's got. He's trying to make this. Now, this intermarriage would have been viewed as a violation of God's promise that he'd made to Jacob, and that his descendants would possess the entire land separately from the other families. They would possess it themselves. So that would be a violation of God's promise to Jacob. And Shechem, the actual offender here, speaks directly to Jacob, seeking to appease him and Dinah's brothers by offering unlimited dowry and gifts to make her his wife, trying to pay him off. And again, Shechem was probably wealthy, quite wealthy as well. So he's trying to pay him off, thinking that would do it. And we'll see what happens to that way. We're offering a moment. Verse 11, and Shechem said unto her father, meaning Jacob, and unto her brethren, let me find grace in your eyes, and what ye shall say unto me I will give. Ask me never so much dowry and gift, and I will give according as ye shall say unto me, but give me the damsel to wife. Again, this economic appeal to a family which has been wronged. And the 12 brothers give an answer in verse 13. And the sons of Jacob answer Shechem and Hamor, his father, deceitfully. There's something about the Jacob family, about deceit, that runs through the bloodlines. But the brothers are upset, and the dad's trying to make peace. And they make this offer, and the brothers, they answer deceitfully, and said, because he had defiled Dinah, their sister, and they said unto him, we cannot do this thing, to give our sister to one that is uncircumcised, for that were a reproach unto us. So the brothers offer a way forward, but it's not what the men of Shechem really were looking for. Verse 15, but in this we will consent unto you, meaning the brothers said we will consent to your offer, if you will be as we be, that every male of you be circumcised. These are adult males. I was circumcised at what, 3 days, 4 days, whatever. Don't remember. Luckily, don't remember it. But I imagine doing it as an adult. And that's what they're offering. You've got to be circumcised as adults. Verse 16. Then will we give our daughters unto you, and we will take your daughters to us, and we will dwell with you, and we will become one people. So they're saying, if you agree to be circumcised, all the men of Shechem, not just the one who committed the defilement, all the men, then we'll agree to this. Verse 17, but if you will not hearken to us to be circumcised, then we will take our daughter and we will be gone. That's a tough offer, but the men, they talk it over. Hamor and Shechem believe that this is a workable solution, not understanding what the brothers have in mind for them. Verse 18, and their words pleased Hamor and Shechem, Hamor's son. And the young man deferred not to do the thing, because he had delight in Jacob's daughter, and he was more honorable than all the house of his father. Now, for those of you who have a handout, I made a mistake in the handout. I said Shechem does not want to do this. It actually, he does want to do this. I inserted the word not. Shechem said, "This, I want to do this. I want to marry the daughter. I'll agree to do this because he wants the marriage to take place immediately." Again, potentially for two reasons. One, he wants to erase his defilement in the eyes of everyone around him. And of course, he wants to tap into Jacob's wealth potentially with this economic solution they're making. So it's a two-for-one here. But he wants to do it quickly. Now, maybe he did care for Dinah. We don't know. The Bible doesn't say that. But he still is acting despicably. So the father and the son and all the men of the town discuss the offer in verse 20. And Hamor and Shechem, his son, came out to the gate of their city and communed with the men of their city, saying, commune means gather together and discuss, saying, these men are peaceable with us. Therefore, let them dwell in the land and trade therein. For the land, behold, it is large enough for them. Let us take their daughters, one of them, to us for wives, and let us give them our daughters. And again, they could have had more children later, of course, the wives, but that's why there's only one now. Verse 22. Only herein will the men consent unto us for to dwell with us, to be one people, if every male among you be circumcised as they are circumcised. I just saw a couple of men go, really? Yeah, that's what the deal is. Now, Hamor pitches the economic value of the deal in verse 23. Shall not their cattle and their substance and every beast of theirs be ours? Only let us consent unto them, and they will dwell with us. So there's the economic appeal. We will take, we will all share, we'll become more rich because of this. So this is what they were appealing to them. Now, all the men of the city, entire city, agreed to the deal. The Bible doesn't say how many men were involved, but it must have been a fairly considerable number. Verse 24. And unto Hamor and unto Shechem, his son, hearkened all that went out of the gate of his city. And every male was circumcised, all that went out of the gate of his city. So they all get circumcised. Now comes the revenge of Simeon and Levi, the two brothers of Dinah. On the third day after the circumcision, the men are really still quite sore. Let's just say they're not combat ready. And this is when Simeon and Levi decide to take their revenge in verse 25. And it came to pass on the third day, when they were sore, that two of his sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brethren, took each man his sword and came upon the city boldly and slew all the males. We don't know how many that was, but probably a considerable number. They were not capable of fighting back, shall we say. And so they killed all of them. Now the other brothers show up, see what's happened, and decide to take the spoils of the city in verse 27. The sons of Jacob came upon the slain and spoiled the city because they had defiled their sister. They didn't disagree with what their brothers had done. They killed all the men. They didn't say, "What? You shouldn't have done this." They said, "Okay, well, so now that we're here, we'll just take everything because they defiled our sister." Verse 28. They took their sheep and their oxen and their asses, and that which was in the city, and that which was in the field, and all their wealth, and all their little ones, and their wives took they captive, and spoiled even all that was in the house. They took everything. Their anger was such that even though their brothers had avenged their sister by killing, well, everybody, they decided, well, it's open season, let's take everything we can get. Not a right act. We'll talk about that later, but just not a right thing to do in any circumstance. And so now Jacob finds out. He's not happy with the action of Simeon and Levi because it threatened the entire family. And again, the Bible does not say what Jacob wanted to do to Shechem for this violation of his daughter. But in that time, there's no such thing as local law. Families handle these circumstances themselves, again, through having enough men and swords, and sometimes there were battles, but as they tried before, they would sometimes work it out with treaties and with marriages to work out these issues. But there was no sheriff to go to. Now, Jacob was more fearful of the local residents attacking them for what his sons had done than for the violation of his own daughter. You say, that's mean, that's rough. It's kind of the circumstance the way it was, because apparently the Shechemites were a large family and they could destroy them. And that's what Jacob's overall concern was for the safety of his entire family. Verse 30, and Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, ye have troubled me. to make me stink, I love that terminology, to make me stink among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites. And I, being few in number, they shall gather themselves together against me and slay me, and I shall be destroyed, I and my house. So that was his fear. They would descend upon them for what his sons had done and destroy all of them. That probably was not an inaccurate fear to have. Now, Simeon and Levi defend their actions in verse 31. And they said, should he deal with our sister as with an harlot? So they said, they got what's coming to them. Right or wrong, they got what's coming to them. That's what the brothers said. Now, as a result of their ruthlessness and their cruelty and the way they behaved in carrying out this massacre, Simeon and Levi are called out by name by their father later in Genesis 49, 1 and 2 and 5 and 7, for their dependents are scattered throughout Israel because of this action. I'll read it. Genesis 49, 1. And Jacob called unto his sons and said, gather yourselves together, that I may tell you that which shall befall you in the last days. Gather yourselves together and hear, ye sons of Jacob, and hearken unto Israel your father. Simeon and Levi are brethren. Instruments of cruelty are in their habitations. And then verse 7. Cursed be their anger, for it was fierce, and their wrath, for it was cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. So both families were scattered and never really had a place of permanence in the country of Israel to come. That was their punishment for this cruelty. Now, a question. Why did God include this in his word? Why did God give us this story, this historical fact about what happened to Dinah and Shechem? What lessons is God trying to teach us here? And a few observations I've learned reading through it. Number one, they need to pray for and actively protect your family. Dinah should not have gone out by herself, I don't think. I mean, one of the brothers should have gone with her, should have protected her. The land was known to be violent, and the Shechemites were known to be violent people. So Dinah should have had protection. Lesson for us is, of course, watch our own children, protect our own children. I told our two daughters growing up, I told you this before, all three things I taught my daughters. Number one, all men are pigs. And we are. Some cases, we're only pigs for a few minutes, but that could be to ruin your life, depending on what happens. Number two, how to say the word no and mean it. I mean, from when they were, so we taught them. Number three, Daddy has a shotgun. Now, I never owned a shotgun. But if you put two 9mm together, it's the same effect. Well, my point is this. I have your back. I'm going to help defend you. If somebody messes with you, they're messing with me. And so I want to show them that we're defending them. And that's how she would treat our children. I'm here to defend you. Boys or girls alike, we should help protect our families. Dinah was left unprotected and a terrible thing happened to her. Now, the Bible does not prohibit lawful self-defense to preserve life. That can be a controversial subject. Some people believe that no Christian can ever do anything violent against anyone else. The Bible disagrees with that. It says it in Matthew, in Luke 22, then said he unto them, but now he hath a purse, let him take it, and likewise his scrip, and he that hath no sword, let him sell his garment and buy one. Why? For self-protection. The law of this country gives us a right for self-protection. Now, there's a fine line, make sure it's self-protection, because people will look at that and wonder. But I was seeing a video the other day in Florida, they passed a law about the Homestead Act, where if somebody enters your house, you can do anything you want to, basically, to them in self-defense. And so this reporter was questioning, does that mean if an unarmed intruder entered their house at night, that the homeowner could then shoot them? And the sheriff said, I disagree with your question. How does the homeowner know they're unarmed? Are they going to ask? Excuse me, before I shoot you, are you armed or not? Let me know. No, they've broken into your house in the middle of the night. There's no time for questions. It's time to defend yourself. So as Christians, we have that right under law, and I think under common sense, to protect our families. Should we go looking for problems? No, of course not. We should try to disengage every chance, especially when it comes to road rage. Have you seen road rage in some of these road rage incidents on video? It's horrible. I mean, driving home, we went to Surrey yesterday to visit Miss Pat Lyons, our precious pastor's widow, love her to death. And driving back, I'm in the second lane from the right, not the merge lane, but the second. And a lady, or somebody in the other lane, I'm almost like this to them, and they turn their blinker on. Okay, I'm here. You can speed up. There's nobody in front of you. You can speed up and turn over or whatever. And they just came over on me. Hit the brakes, hit the horn. Was I mad? Yes, I was mad. Should I have run in front of them and run them off the road? Of course not. And I forgave him. No, I didn't do that. But, I mean, that's what people do when they get angry. They engage by getting in front of them and slowing down, brake checking them, whatever. No, we should try to disengage. I blew the horn so she wouldn't, or he or she wouldn't run into me. But when that happens, we should take a breath, disengage, and don't make it worse. But if somebody breaks into my apartment at 1 o'clock in the morning, they're going to meet Mr. Sig up close and personal. Sig is a handgun. I'm going to defend my wife. I'm going to defend myself. So Dinah deserved and should have had protection. So we should protect our children. We should protect ourselves. The second point, the evil of sexual influences in our society. You see that on the internet and all. People are overly sexualized, and so kids these days are just overly sexualized, and it makes it even tougher to defend our children against this kind of influence. And the results can be devastating. We have to worry about the perils and dangers of vengeance. As Christians, we should never try to seek vengeance. We should leave that to the Lord. By the way, men no longer respect or protect women, I think, in our society, and they should. But we need to teach our young men to protect women and to respect them. You say women don't deserve it because of the way they dress. It doesn't matter. They still deserve protection and respect. No matter how they dress, how they act, that's not an open door to act, treat them any differently. Respect them and protect them at all times. But this perils of vengeance. The boys took vengeance against this whole city. Now, we may not always like it or trust it, but we must rely on our justice system to do the right thing. And as Christians especially, it's easy to get angry, but the Bible teaches us to forgive those who trespass against us, as long as it's not in a self-defense mechanism. We can shoot them and forgive them later. But you defend yourself. But if somebody cuts in front of you, I blew the horn, but I didn't chase them down. If somebody does you wrong, do your best to forgive them and not take vengeance on them. The greatest example I've seen in my lifetime was Charlie Kirk's widow. Just days after Charlie Kirk was murdered, in a public memorial service, she gave the man who did it. And I believe it was honest forgiveness. It was a great thing to witness. And the crowd, of course, they broke up. And I think she meant it. So forgiveness is a tough thing to do, but it's deserved, and we should give forgiveness. The brothers didn't give forgiveness. They chose vengeance, and they paid a price for that sin. So that's the massacre at Shechem. Chapter 35, the covenant renewal, birth, and death. Now, Jacob has returned to Canaan. He's wrestled with an angel. He suffered a permanent injury to his hip. He's reconciled with his brother Esau. He saw his sons commit a massacre in Shechem to revenge his sister. Now, God tells Jacob to return to Bethel to renew their covenant. Chapter 35, verse 1. And God said unto Jacob, Arise, go to Bethel and dwell there. And make there an altar unto God, and that appeared unto thee when thou fleddest from the face of Esau, thy brother. And so God gives him specific instructions, and he does that. Now, Jacob tells his entire household to put away their idols, to clean up, and put on fresh clothes before they go to Bethel. He wants to present a perfect sacrifice or a perfect appearance to God at Bethel for his entire household. Remember, his household, Rachel, idols, she stole. She still has those? Probably. We'll see. Verse 2. Then Jacob said unto his household and to all that were with them, Put away the strange gods that are among you, and be clean, and change your garments. Put on a purple tie. And let us arise and go up to Bethel, and I will make there an altar unto God, who answered me in the day of my distress when he was meeting Esau, and was with me in the way which I went. So, he tells the entire household that the household obeys him. Does Rachel put away her idols? The Bible doesn't say, but we think probably so, because A, Jacob had already pronounced a death sentence on whoever had taken them. Remember when Laban showed up, he said, Where are my idols? He said, Whoever you find has them, kill them. And so Rachel hit him in a very creative way. So she still has them. That death sentence is still in effect. So she doesn't be caught with them. And Jacob has specifically instructed them to put away their idols. We're going to go meet God at Bethel. Put away your idols. So it's entirely possible that she got in line or gave it to somebody else in line and they dumped it at the idol stand when they were giving away their idols. So I believe she gave away her idol and got rid of it. It's likely she did. Now again, she hadn't told her husband she stole them and she wanted to make sure he didn't find out. Now, verse 4, and they gave unto Jacob all the strange gods which were in their hand, and all their earrings which were in their ears, and Jacob hid them under the oak which was by Shechem. So all of them were turned in. I think this one was given away too. They're all gone. All the idols have disappeared. Now, remember, this was after the massacre at Shechem. And it's still possible that some of the local residents who heard about what happened wants to take revenge and slay them. And so they have to worry about this as they're traveling to Bethel. But God takes care of them in verse 5. And they journeyed, and the terror of God was upon the cities that were round about them, and they did not pursue after the sons of Jacob. There was divine panic amongst the locals. Don't touch Jacob and his family. God intervened and said, don't touch them. And they were afraid of him, so they left them alone as they traveled. Now they arrive, and Jacob builds an altar to God in verse 6. So Jacob came to Luz, which is in the land of Canaan, that is, Bethel, he and all his people that were with him. And he built there an altar and called the place El Bethel, because God appeared unto him when he fled from the face of his brother. Now, there's a lot of altar building in the Old Testament, as you know. They're always building altars to God to mark specific events and wonderful events. Why don't we build altars today to God?
Because we've already had the perfect sacrifice in Jesus.
That's true. But I think we do build altars to God every day with our witness. Every time you witness somebody, that's an altar unto God. You're blessing God by witnessing to someone. Your testimony is an altar to God. If somebody sees you as a Christian doing good things and you have a great testimony, that's an altar unto God, right? Because you're praising God. Our children are altars to God. If we raise them right, they get godly children to God, and it's an altar to Him. Our tithes are a form of an altar. We're blessing God with our tithes. Prayer. Every time you pray, it's an altar. You're altering to God. You're praying to God. You're offering up your prayers. And in kindness, everyday kindness, somebody opening a door, helping somebody with a package, whatever. Those are all, I think, altars. And I don't want to make physical altars, but certainly altars to God to honor Him for what He's done to us. Yesterday, we were coming back from Surrey, which is, you know, Surrey is 22 miles away from us as the crow flies, but it takes an hour to get there. So you have to go either way up north or way down south to get across the river to get over there. So we came back from Surrey. We took the ferry back, a wonderful trip on a ferry if you've never done that. So we're coming back, and the wife says, I've got 727 packages, so can we stop and get the packages? And so we stopped off at our Amazon box to get the packages. And I've got these two nice people walked up, older couple walked up, says, do you mind if we ask you a question? Okay. And they said, we're looking to move here in our apartment complex, and we don't know what you think about it. Can you give us some feedback? So we talked for 20 minutes or so. Sweet couple, Christian couple, go to Liberty Baptist Church. He's retired Air Force, a chief. I'm only an E8. He has me ranked. Wonderful people, wonderful testimony. We shared information and gave him information about the living there and about the church and about their church. A wonderful time was had by us all, even though we didn't know each other. Now we're friends. That's a testimony that, you know, you say, what do you want? No, you can't talk to me. You can't ask me any questions. No, he said, well, what do you got? I was afraid they were trying to sell us something when they first walked up. Do you have life insurance? But no, sweet, sweet, kind people. Those kind of interactions are a blessing when you have them, because you can share your testimony, but you can also, with fellow Christians, you can just share and praise God. And she said it, God set this up. God made this happen, because we need to meet good people, and you're good people. And they're great people. And so that in itself is an altar unto God. We're blessing God by our actions. And so it was a wonderful time yesterday. So we do build altars after a fashion, not physical altars, but certainly emotional and spiritual altars to God, and should each and every day. So now, that altar has been built, but now something happens. Rebecca's nurse dies and is buried in the area, verse 8. And Deborah, Rebecca's nurse, died, and she was buried beneath Bethel under an oak. And the name of it was called Allen Baketh. Thank you, his name I keep forgetting, the guy who reads the Bible. Was it?
Spurgeon?
No, anyway, the Bible. I get the pronunciation from him. Allen Baketh. And that means oak of weeping is what that means. So that's a bad thing that's happened. We're moving forward. God appears to Jacob again, affirms his new name of Israel, and renews his covenant. Chapter 35, verse 9. And God appeared unto Jacob again when he came out of Padan Aram and blessed him. And God said unto him, thy name is Jacob. Thy name shall not be called any more Jacob, but Israel shall be thy name. And he called his name Israel. And God said unto him, I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply, a nation and a company of nations shall be of thee, and kings shall come out of their loins. Again, that reformation, that reaffirmation of that covenant that his people would inhabit the country. Verse 12. And the land which I gave Abraham and Isaac, I give to thee, I will give. And to thy seed after thee will I give the land. And God went up from him in the place where he talked with him. That happened at Bethel. Now Jacob marks the spot that this happened and honors it in verse 14. And Jacob set up a pillar in the place where he talked with him, even a pillar of stone. And he poured a drink offering thereon, and he poured oil thereon. And Jacob called the name of the place where God spake to him, Bethel, which means house of God. So another great interaction between God and his servant. Verse 16. And they journeyed from Bethel, and there was but a little way come to Ephraim, and Rachel travailed, and she had hard labor. Now Rachel is pregnant. Remember, she's only had one child to this point. Despite stealing the idols and everything else she tried to do, she only had one child, but clearly she's pregnant and she's about to give birth. And she had, now Leah had six sons and a daughter, so she was always under pressure to have more children. And so even after the mandrake situation we talked about the other week, she still only had one child. She's pregnant with a second child, but there is a problem. Verse 17. And it came to pass when she was in hard labor, that the midwife said unto her, Fear not, thou shalt have this son also. The midwife saw that Rachel was in trouble physically, and she wanted to know she was having a son to make her feel better. And so the midwife sensed what was happening and wanted her to feel better about having a son. Verse 18. And it came to pass, as her soul was in departing, for she died, that she called his name Benoni, but his father called him Benjamin. Benjamin, good name. Benoni means son of my sorrow or misfortune, which is what she was thinking. He changed it to Benjamin, which means son of my right hand, which is an honorable position to have. So Rachel passes away in childbirth, verse 19. And Rachel died and was buried in the way to Ephraim, which is Bethlehem. And Jacob set a pillar upon her grave, that is the pillar of Rachel's grave until this day. Now, was Rachel's death linked in any way to stealing the idols and her behavior? No one knows. The Bible doesn't say that. But in any event, Jacob grieves over the loss of his favorite wife. And it's terrible for him to have to lose his wife because she wasn't that old. And she was dying. She had died in childbirth. So he buries his wife and they continue their journey. Verse 21. And Israel, Jacob, journeyed and spread his tent beyond the tower of Edar. Now, remember Reuben, the son by Leah, he commits a transgression here in verse 22. And it came to pass, when Israel dwelt in that land, that Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine. And Israel, Jacob, heard it. Now the sons of Jacob were 12. Now this term, Israel heard it, indicates there's going to be consequences. He's going to pay for this. Doesn't do it here, but we see later how he pays for that. So what were the consequences of Reuben's sin? He lost his birthright. As the firstborn, Reuben should have had a double portion of the inheritance, but that was given to Joseph. He had a loss of leadership, for Jacob declared on his deathbed, because Reuben had went us into thy father's bed, he would not excel or have any preeminence in the family longer. There was a stigma attached to his name, because Reuben was described by his father as unstable as water. How would you like to have that on your annual review? You're as unstable as water. Remember I told you, mine said, no one had anything negative to say about you, Dave. That's so nice. No one had anything negative to say about you. Okay. I asked the boss last week, because Jackie was sick, had a telework on Thursday. He said, yeah, because no one knows when you're here or not. I'm kidding. He said that. Feel special. At least he didn't say I was unstable as water. Okay, that's a description. He was unstable as water. He permanently damaged his reputation because of this act. He also lost his blessing. When his descendants formed one of the tribes of Israel, they did not lead the nation and eventually settled east of the Jordan River, often experienced separation from the main body of Israel, all because of Reuben's sin. So sin has its consequences here. Now, verses 23 through 26 list the 12 sons of Jacob, representing the future 12 tribes of Israel. I'm not going to read all those. You can read them. But they're the 12 sons he had. Each one becomes a tribe of Israel. And going down in verse 27, Jacob and Isaac have a reunion in Mamre, which is Hebron, shortly before Isaac's death. Verse 27. And Jacob came unto Isaac his father, and to Mamre, in the city of Arabah, which is Hebron, where Abraham and Isaac sojourned. Now, Isaac is 180 years old, and he passes away. And the two formerly warring sons, Esau and Jacob, reunite to bury their father. Verse 28. And the days of Isaac were 104 years, and Isaac gave up the ghost and died, and was gathered unto his people, being old and full of days, and his sons Esau and Jacob buried him. Back when they were stealing, he was stealing his birthright, you'd think they'd ever reunite like this, but they have. Brothers have reunited, and all is forgiven, and they bury their father. So, we'll cover very briefly, chapter 36 lists all the descendants of Esau. And again, great for historian purposes, for biblical historian purposes. We're not going to read all that because it's just a list of all the descendants. Some of this is important to our study. It's all important. But we don't go through all 43 verses of who begat who because that's just important for historical purposes, biblical historical purposes, but it's not really what we're going to go through today. So chapter 36, verse 1 says, now these are the generations of Esau, who is Edom. Esau took his wives of the daughters of Canaan, and it lists the wives and the children, and it goes on down through verse 7. For their riches were more than that they may dwell together, and the land wherein they were strangers could not bear them because of their cattle. So they take, Jacob and Esau make a decision to separate because both families and flocks have gotten too big again to cohabitate, and they separate. And so Esau and Jacob cohabit, depart from each other. Verse 8, thus dwelt Esau in Mount Seir. Esau is Edom. So again, it describes genealogy. It describes how the flocks and the families had gotten too big and Esau had left and they separated. So that's chapter 36. I don't mean to minimize it, but going through all the genealogy really isn't achieving anything for us. Biblical historians use it to track families and all the genealogies. So we'll go to chapter 37. This is an important chapter. Jacob's history and his slavery. Now, chapter 37 starts with a remarkable story of Joseph, Jacob's son. It contains stories of favoritism, dreams, betrayal, slavery, deception, and the arrival of Joseph into Egypt. The storyline now backs up a bit. We're backing up about 10 to 12 years from the end of chapter 35 when Isaac passes away. Isaac's still alive at the beginning of chapter 37 because he talks about how much he enjoys his son, Joseph. So we're backing up about 10 or 12 years. Chapter 37, verse 1, and Jacob dwelt in the land wherein his father was a stranger in the land of Canaan. So Canaan, where his father was a stranger, Isaac lived in Canaan, but he was known as a stranger. He was a wanderer. He never bought land or settled down. So that's why he was known as a stranger in Canaan. We see that a 17-year-old Joseph was feeding the flock of their father Jacob, verse 2. These are the generations of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brethren. And the lad was with the sons of Bilhah, and with the sons of Zilpah, and his father's wives. And Joseph brought unto his father their evil report. So what does Joseph do? He tells on his brothers. He delivers an evil report to their father. The brothers clearly were doing something wrong. Joseph saw it and went back. You say, tattletale? Probably. But brothers do that, right? I was the youngest of three. If my other two brothers did something, well, I'm straight to mom. You know what Billy did? You know what Mike did? You know what they did? I'm straight to them. That's what I did. And I'll get paid for it later. But that's what brothers do. So he delivered a report to his father of his brother's misbehavior, this evil report. And I think it's not clear what it was, but it created tensions among the brothers. Now, Jacob, known as Israel, favored Joseph more than any of his other children, and because he was the son of his old age. And this created even more tension with the brothers. And Jacob, Israel, made a special present for his son. Verse 3. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children because he was a son of his old age. And he made him a coat of many colors. Now there's a song about that, but it's a famous story about the coat of many colors. Verse 4. And when his brethren saw that their father loved him more than all his brethren, they hated him and could not speak peaceably unto him. Brothers can argue, can they not? Brothers can argue. There's 12 of them. That's 12 chances to have a disagreement. But seeing a parent favor one over the other, that's a huge disagreement. That's a huge problem. And the brothers see this, and they really don't like Joseph and the way that their father is treating him over them. Now, Joseph has a dream, and this created more tension amongst the brothers. the sheaves of grain dream. Verse 5. And Joseph dreamed a dream, and he told it to his brethren, and they hated him yet the more. And he said to them, "Hear, I pray you, this dream which I have dreamed. For behold, we are binding sheaves in the field." Sheaves are grain, sheaves of grain. "And lo, my sheaf arose and also stood upright. And behold, your sheaves stood around about and made obeisance to my sheaf." Your grain worshiped my grain, is what he's saying. It was a dream, but it was indication of a primary position that he was going to have. And the brothers didn't like that. He dreams another dream. Verse 8, the brethren react. And his brethren said to him, "Shalt thou indeed reign over us? Or shalt thou indeed have dominion over us? And behold, your sheaves stood around about," and they hated him more, yet more for his dreams and for his words. So the reaction wasn't, well, it would be what you expect from the brothers. But Joseph has another dream, verse 9. And he dreamed yet another dream and told his brethren and said, "Behold, I have dreamed a dream more. And behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars made obeisance to me." Now, the sun and the moon represent his father, the sun, and his mom, the moon. The 11 brothers, his other brothers, were those 11 stars. And they said they all made obeisance to him. Now he told this dream, and this even earns a rebuke from his own father, verse 10. And he told it to his father and to his brethren, and his father rebuked him and said unto him, "What is this dream that thou hast dreamed? Shall I and thy mother and thy brethren indeed come to bow down ourselves to thee, to the earth?" So the father said, "What are you talking about?" Now, the brothers were jealous of him. They were angry with him. But yet we see in verse 11 that the father, on second thought, he's contemplating the meaning of this dream. Verse 11. And his brethren envied him, but his father observed the saying. God's trying to tell somebody something here. Let me figure out what's going on. So, now it's time for the brothers to tend to the flocks. In verse 12. And his brethren went out to feed their father's flock in Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, "Do thy brethren feed the flock in Shechem? Come, and I will send thee unto them." And he said to him, "Here am I." So his father sends him out. Now again, he's young, he's 17, but he sends him out to join his brethren, basically check up on him. What dad said, go see what they're doing right. Verse 14. And he said to him, "Go, I pray thee, see whether it be well with thy brethren, and well with the flocks, and bring me word again." So he sent him out of the vale of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. So on his way, he either gets lost or on the way, a stranger finds him and kind of directs him to the right location in verse 15. And a certain man found him, and behold, he was wandering in the field. And the man asked him, saying, "What seekest thou?" And he said, "I seek my brethren. Tell me, I pray thee, where they feed their flocks." And the man said, "They are departed hence, for I heard them. Let us go to Dothan." And Joseph went after his brethren and found them in Dothan. I didn't know the story took place in Alabama. Come on. I looked it up. Dothan's in Alabama, right? Born in Alabama. There's a Dothan, Alabama. Clearly there were other Dothan. Dothan still exists, by the way, in the land of Israel. Called something else Dothan, but it's still there. So it took him to Dothan. Now, the brothers see Joseph coming, and they conspire to kill him in verse 18. And when they saw him afar off, even before he came near unto them, they conspired against him to slay him. And they said one to another, "Behold, the dreamer cometh. Come now, therefore, and let us slay him and cast him into some pit, and we will say some evil beast hath devoured him, and we will see what will become of his dreams." So they laid a trap for him. Now, Reuben is leading this effort, and Reuben had a very complex and contrary life. He was the one that found the mandrakes and brought him to his mother Leah. He was the firstborn and heir, but lost the privilege because he slept with his father's concubine. He was described by his father again as being as unstable as water, and declared he would not excel. Yet he strives here to save his brother's life and return him to their home in verse 21. And Reuben heard it, and he delivered him out of their hands and said, "Let us not kill him." And Reuben said unto them, "Shed no blood, but cast him into this pit that is in the wilderness, and lay no hand upon him, that he might rid him out of their hands to deliver him to his father again." His plan was, throw him in his pit, you guys go off, I'll circle back, I'll take him out of the pit, and take him home. So he really wanted to save his brother's life. And it came to pass when Joseph was come unto his brethren, we're on verse 23 now, that they stripped Joseph out of his coat of many colors that was on him. And they took him and cast him into a pit, and the pit was empty, there was no water in it. So they throw him in the pit, take off the coat of many colors, throw him in the pit. They think their job is done. So now, while eating, the brothers notice a caravan coming on. They've left the pit, and they see a caravan while they're eating dinner or lunch. Judah proposes selling Joseph. So let's get some money from this guy. We'll sell him. And they will sell him to the Midianites and the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver. Now, again, according to the historians, 20 pieces of silver or shekels was a price for a slave in those days. So it's basically selling their own brother as a slave. Verse 25, and they sat down to eat bread, the brothers did, and they lifted up their eyes and looked, and behold, a company of Ishmaelites came from Gilead with their camels, bearing spicery and balm and myrrh, going to carry it down to Egypt. And Judah said unto his brethren, what profit is it if we slay our brother and conceal his blood? Come, and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh. And his brethren were content. And then there passed by Midianites merchantmen, and they drew and lifted up Joseph out of the pit, and sold Joseph to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver, and they brought Joseph unto Egypt. So again, 20 pieces of silver was a going rate for a male slave in that period. And so they lift him out of the pit, sell him to the Midianites and the Ishmaelites, while Reuben's away. So they leave. Reuben circles back to take his brother out of the pit, and he finds the pit is empty. Verse 29. And Reuben returned unto the pit, and behold, Joseph was not in the pit, and he rent his clothes. And he returned to his brother and said, the child is not, and I, whither shall I go? Reuben apparently thought that they had come back and actually killed him. That they'd actually gone and killed him. And so he was horrified. He rent his clothes in mourning over his dead brother. And the brothers didn't set him straight. Yeah, he's dead. So they said in verse 31, thank you. 31. And they took Joseph's coat, that coat of many colors, and killed a kid of goats, and dipped the coat in the blood. And they sent the coat of many colors that they brought to their father and said, this have we found. Know not whether it be thy son's coat or not. Do you think this is his? They were loving the fact they were deceiving their father into thinking that his son had been killed by showing this coat covered in blood. Now, Reuben still thinks that they had done it. But either way, he thinks that Joseph is dead. And so, verse 33, they were talking about Jacob or Israel now. And he knew it and said, it is my son's coat. An evil beast had devoured him. Joseph is without double rent in pieces. And Jacob rent his clothes and put sackcloth on his loins and mourned for his son many days. And all his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him. But he refused to be comforted. For he said, for I will go down into the grave unto my son mourning. This his father wept for him. So he really thinks his son is dead. He's mourning for him. He's weeping for him. So what really happened to Joseph? Verse 36. And the Midianites sold him unto Egypt, unto Potiphar, the officer of Pharaoh's, and captain of the guard. So they are all making profit off of Joseph. They're selling him left and right. Now, we'll get in next week this Pharaoh's guard and what happens to Joseph when he goes. But they take him all the way to Egypt, and they're using him as a servant on the Pharaoh's guard, the captain of the guard, use him as a servant. But God blesses him and protects him. We'll see that happens next week. But you see this amazing story of the life of Joseph, what all happens to him, how God protects him. And we'll get into more in that next week. Let's pray. Father,